Well, we're being told there are all sorts of things about government that we can no longer afford. So can we still afford to be prosecuting crimes that have no victims? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we're exploring two areas where some people want to see decriminalization, cannabis and prostitution. I imagine there will be a few phone calls on this one. Our statewide phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We will meet our expert panel in just a moment on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Providence Imaging Center, with Doctors Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Okay, just to start with, I'll say that this is an exploration of a subject. Well, what we're doing here is exploring. I'm not really into taking a position or, you know, pushing any kind of agenda, but simply exploring these issues that hardly ever get explored on the radio. And I've got fantastic and well-qualified guests, and I think the ground rules here are that the guests are here for you, the listener, to have conversations with, and they're happy to do that. And if there's a problem, you know, we'll just say that can't do that, that's out of bounds, and that could easily happen. But for the most part, they are resources who have advocate these positions and are willing to come on the radio and talk about it, and we thank them very much for it. I'm going to start by introducing a guest that we had on just 2 weeks ago and even before that, and that is journalist, researcher, and author Leo Morgan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Leo.
Good morning.
And our conversation about your book, Good Time Girls, and the musical that has been made from it, Gold Rush Girls, kind of led to an exploration of how we might have some mistaken beliefs about prostitution and about how things went down. And that's one of the reasons I'm really happy to have you here on the program today.
I appreciate the chance to be here. Thank you, Steve.
Also joining us from an undisclosed location is Mistress Max. Now, she's going to be somewhat anonymous, and it's not for lack of brass and chutzpah. It is simply because, actually, there's legal considerations. It's actually a crime to say you're a prostitute. It's actually a crime. I don't know how that gets around the Fifth Amendment and the First Amendment, but nonetheless, it is. So with some protection of anonymity by telephone, Mistress Max, an organizer of the Erotic Service Providers Union in the Bay Area, and I guess elsewhere as well, is with us. Mistress Max, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve.
And I understand, Mistress Max, that you are you're an experienced broadcast personality. In other words, you've actually been on the air and dealt with listeners about these kind of subjects down there in the Bay Area on Pacifica Radio.
Yes, you know, we have a little bit different laws in California regarding prostitution. You can say you're a prostitute without being arrested. Now, that is in great contrast to the laws in Anchorage, Alaska, where you can be arrested for practicing prostitution. So just admitting that you're a practicing prostitute is a misdemeanor. It's a criminal offense in Alaska, and yes, it does violate, obviously, your First Amendment right. And so for that reason, I just want to make sure that I have a little bit of anonymity and protection in that way, which is unfortunate. You know, I should be able to just be able to talk more freely. But there's a lot of information to share with listeners that they might be interested in.
Great, great. And I'm sure you'll enjoy some of the research that Leo has on this issue, particularly as it pertains to Alaska. I want to introduce our third guest. Yes, yet another guest. This is the author of the soon-to-be best-selling, I'm sure, Too High to Fail. It can't be a bestseller yet because you can't get it yet because it only doesn't come out for another couple of days. But he's known to some of our listeners. He's been on before to talk about his book, Farewell, My Subaru. He's the former news director of radio station KHNS. And he is Mr. Doug Fine. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Doug.
Hey, great to be back with you, Steve. This is the way to launch a book. Spread the news in the last frontier.
Yeah, and of course, the subject that you are writing about in Too High to Fail is a subject that, as you know, having been in Alaska, is somewhat treasured issue to be discussed in the state of Alaska. So we're really glad to have you on about that and hear the benefits of all your research and the information you put together in this book. Maybe we can start with you and just kind of summarizing the case that you ended up with. Because I know you've already appeared on Conan O'Brien, so it's not like we're violating any kind of embargo here. But essentially, in this book, you look at the medical marijuana industry in great detail, but then kind of expand out to talk about history and so forth, and you end up with an enormous bottom line. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that bottom line.
Yeah, I hope everybody's sitting down, because I know this is a strange topic to Alaskans, but the drug war is not working, is my journalistic conclusion. 40 years on, $1 trillion of taxpayer money spent to no effect on supply or demand. By stopping that, by getting cannabis out of the Controlled Substances Act, we could cripple up to 70% of the Mexican cartels, revenue and transfer billions every year into the legal American economy, just like Thomas Jefferson wanted it.
Billions of dollars. I choke on the billions. I mean, I could see the hundreds of millions, but how do you get to billions, Doug?
Well, let's start with just the one county where I did my research, because it's billions just within the tiny county of Mendocino in Northern California. They have 80,000 residents. And the estimated revenue, I think it's a conservative number, within the county now is $6 billion, most of it untaxed, most of it having to deal with criminals and all that jazz on the distribution end. And where that number comes from is based on value of crop seizure within the county that the law enforcement estimates is 10% of the crop. The growers say it's like 1%. So being generous and calling it 10%, that comes to $6 billion of revenue in Little Mendocino County, California. The number one legal crop there, grapes, is $74 million. So if you're a 4-H farmer trying to decide what industry to go into, which would you choose?
A career with a future, Doug.
People like their cannabis. Yeah, for the last few thousand years, yeah.
And, of course, in California, as two of our guests well know, I'm sure that they have these kind of medical marijuana clubs and outlets now, right? So it's actually become fairly easy to, you know, for a person to go through the hoops. You can do it in Alaska, too, but the hoops are a little bit more stringent. When you say
Alaska's cannabis history is very, very interesting, of course, with the legalization in 1975 backed up by the Alaska Supreme Court. But in California, that's true. And the tax revenue last year paid by the cannabis industry, not any kind of residual benefit, but just sales tax on cannabis dispensaries and collectives in California was $100 million. So that's with, you know, tiny percentage of the crop into the white market or gray market. Imagine if all the cannabis in the U.S., which is nation's number one cash crop, imagine if all that became taxed like alcohol.
Were you, you've been working on this book for a while. Were you shocked by your own conclusions?
To a degree I was. I mean, I knew that the drug war wasn't working, but I didn't realize just how ridiculously it's being fought. I mean, really, going after the wrong people while letting the cartels be. And the actual drug warriors, law enforcement folks that are fighting the battle, are doing the best they can. That's not the problem. The problem is it's an ill-conceived war that shouldn't be being fought. It's bad for America, and for the most part, it's fighting against Americans, including drones. Drones have been approved in the 2013 defense appropriations budget for domestic use in fighting the drug war.
Okay, I got lots more questions for you, Doug Fine, but hang in there. I want to switch back to Mistress Max. And get a little bit of a rundown on why you don't advocate legalization so much as decriminalization of prostitution.
Well, that's right. Our situation is a little bit different from the prohibition on cannabis. You know, the prohibition on cannabis is a federal one, whereas the prohibition on prostitution is done mostly at the state level. So it's the state and local municipalities who enforce the anti-prostitution laws. And they have been prostitution has been criminal throughout the United States in different every county, every state that is, except for a couple of counties there in Nevada, where they do have legalized brothels. I wouldn't necessarily call it legalized prostitution because it just gives the right to the brothel owners to run brothels. It doesn't really bring any, you know, right to negotiate for your own labor and your own work conditions for the actual workers, the prostitutes. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're not really crazy about the legalized model as it stands in the United States. And we need to have decriminalization of prostitution first so we can bring actual workers and people involved in the prostitution industry to the forefront of their own advocacy. Because right now, under the criminalization of prostitution laws, as I said, in Alaska, you can be arrested for talking about prostitution and being an actual practicing prostitute. So, you know, we want to get actual workers to the center of their own voice first, and that has to be decriminalization. We also need to have some anti-discrimination laws in place so that when workers do come out and, you know, family members of workers come out and talk about their family member being involved in prostitution or, you know, people hiring each other to in support services for prostitution, like to drive somebody to an out call. You know, those people need to be decriminalized and to have some anti-discrimination in place so that they're not discriminated against in housing or in employment or in education or in child custody because, you know, we have to have some legal protections under the law, and we don't have that right now. We don't have access to equal protection. And I guess that's kind of where prostitution and the cannabis growers and users intersect, is that we don't really have access to equal protection under the law, and we should all have that.
Mr. Smacks, you have obviously put a lot of thought into this. And how long is this effort to organize, to actually have organized labor in this field been going on?
Well, I've been organizing with organized labor and getting workers into organized labor school for since 2004. But I had predecessors, you know, here in San Francisco. You know, we had the Lusty Ladies Theater, which is a peep show style theater, who have been organized through Service Employees International local for about 10 years. So they, well, maybe it's been a little longer than 10 years, and their story is depicted in a movie called Live Nude Girls Unite. And that's a very famous movie. It's won a lot of awards. And actually, I just had some lunch with some former Lusty Ladies who meet up once a year and have a little barbecue and talk about the good old times of working at the Lusty. The Lusty is still in operation. They're still organized. But they were able to organize because they were hourly wage workers as opposed to independent contractors, which is what primarily the majority of the workers in the sex industry work under, are those independent contractors.
Yeah, and right. That's a familiar dodge in almost every industry now.
Mm-hmm. And I know that there was a great effort to organize the dispensary workers in California under, I think it was the United Food Commercial Workers, until they got that really horrible letter from Obama's administration, from his attorney generals, to shut down those dispensaries.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah, very, very good. And I already questions coming in by email. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255 statewide to speak with our panelists today. Local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. And I'll turn back to you, Doug Fine. Because I know one thing that for some reason people don't really realize is that marijuana was not cannabis, I guess we'll say, was not even involved. The federal law did not even consider cannabis until fairly recently, right?
The federal prohibition of cannabis actually began in 1937. The date that's given for this sort of 40-year drug war is Nixon's speech in 1971, which soon after created the DEA, which is now a huge industry itself, billions of dollars, thousands of employees, rather, every year. And this is really the hardest part about ending the drug war, or at least the war on cannabis, is because a lot of jobs depend on it. There's a growing private prison industry. And it's just not a way to run an economy. It's not America we want. Shareholder revenues are all terrific on Wall Street, but when the point is incarcerating people for nonviolent use of an ancient plant, which is pretty much the driving engine of the drug war, that's no way to run a country. And people who agree with this include televangelist Pat Robertson, Ronald Reagan, Secretary of State George Shultz, of course, the presidents of just about everyone in Latin America, and 56% of the American people now favor full regulation of cannabis like alcohol. 80 to 90% are in support of medical cannabis, but 56% are just in favor of saying, stop it, stop this misspending of our tax dollars.
Well, I have a suspicion you won't find a single person in Congress, maybe two, actually, when I think about it, that would take that position.
Yeah, the former governor of New Mexico, now Libertarian presidential candidate named Gary Johnson, he calls the drug, he's always been, even way before his time, governor here in the 80s in the land of enchantment, always been trying to end the drug war. And he calls it the biggest disconnect between America and her leaders. And I don't think the rhetoric is so much a part of it anymore. Barack Obama was able to win a hearty, hearty majority of the electorate in the last election by openly campaigning on decriminalizing cannabis and ending the drug war.
He hasn't exactly done it.
No, he hasn't.
Okay, this one from Mistress Max comes from Carl. And I'm sure you've heard this one before. I think there is an idealized version of a liberated woman who freely chooses prostitution as a lifestyle. We think perhaps of high-priced courtesans, geishas, etc., but the reality is that many prostitutes are, in fact, slaves brought in to provide sex, and many are forced to become addicts as well. How do we decriminalize prostitution and still protect women from being sold into the sexual slave trade as they are now?
I'm sorry. I have to laugh when I hear questions like this.
I knew you would.
I've been in the business for decades, and I have just never seen that. I know that it's very popular narrative right now, but that narrative, you have to understand, that narrative comes from basically the U.S. government that passed the Anti-Trafficking Victim Act of 2000, and it started to fund all of these nonprofits to promote this very idea and this very narrative about conflating prostitution with sex slaves and calling into question, really in a most disrespectful way, the idea that those of us who work in the business are, we don't have any agency, that we're all being forced to have drugs and that whole business of it. And, I've never had to use any drugs the whole time I have worked in the business. And one of the reasons we advocate so hard for decriminalization is because we want some transparency in our industry. And we want to be able to show how it is that when we do come across situations that we feel are exploitive in some way, that we already have our ways of dealing with them. We just can't be very public about it. For example, if a customer, we've got several stories of customers who come across women who they have a question about should be in the business, and they'll provide her with some means to make an exit. They'll provide the getaway car, they'll provide cell phones and money to help that person move on to a place where they would rather be. And you never get to hear those kinds of stories because of the criminalization of prostitution, which really amounts to criminalizing people's speech and criminalizing them to be able to talk freely about our situations. You know, when there are situations of exploitation, we need to really understand that those are bad work conditions. And without workers having access to, you know, be more self-determined in their ability to create work conditions that they would prefer, then, yes, there's always going to be exploitation. And that's why we talk about rights and bringing workers' rights and people rights instead of criminalizing them. And this business of, you know, who is profiting off the criminalization of prostitution in America, it's really the police departments, and it's really these nonprofits who work hand in hand, who have actually become an extension of the prison industrial complex, because they profit when the police arrest us for prostitution and then try to use the criminal proceedings to force us into these exiting programs, where these nonprofits then get paid by the government again to try to force us out of working as prostitutes and force us onto welfare and forcing us into receiving services.
Wow.
And this kind of business. So it's really, that's who's really profiting off the criminalization of prostitution today.
You're definitely twisting my head around, Mistress Max, and this is very enjoyable to me. I want to bring in Lael and go back to the gold rush era. And I know we went into this a couple of weeks ago, this business of women in prostitution meeting a bad end, and you said they can't find any numbers to bring that to reality.
Well, the white slave hysteria actually started in London just before the turn of the century. If you read your newspapers there, and it came to the United States, women were being trapped in the industry, and it turned out to be a myth, and has been proven as such, as a lot of myths, that all prostitutes ended up drug addicted, committed suicide. In Montana, an academic writer took a look at those statistics in Helena and discovered that in 35 years there'd been two suicides, that the statistics do not show death because of prostitute-related. In fact, my research shows that a lot of people in the trade went for a couple of years or 3 years or 6 years and then got out, or they moved up into management. But all this, oh my goodness, they aren't going to last a minute. The graveyards of the West are filled with dead prostitutes. There are no statistics that show that.
Wow. And I think it's interesting. I think maybe now is the time to bring in this business of the special situation of Alaska that you wrote about in your book, Good Time Girls, which was even to the point of that women arriving would be asked. I guess you couldn't do that nowadays, huh?
Well, when the line was started in Fairbanks, it was started by Archdeacon Stuck of the Episcopal Church, because some of the miners were getting robbed and rolled by prostitutes and their pimps. And what he did to organize it was he got a batch of land. He let the prostitutes buy in at a reasonable price, so they didn't need pimps. And he wrote the rules, which the city enforced. And each prostitute was paid a fine every month, which actually is how Fairbanks got organized. And you're right, the city attorney met every boat, and he asked every woman, are you a lady or a whore? If you're a lady, pass on. If you're a whore, that will be $17.50 this month.
That's mind-blowing. What do you make of that, Mistress Max?
Well, this business of taxing people without representation is been a long time issue. I think that probably back in the day, you know, as Lael has written about, women and prostitutes had more agency than what we do now. Many of us do pay taxes on an individual basis to the federal government and to the state and to local municipalities because we have licenses to operate. We just have to call ourselves something different.
I see. So, yeah, yeah. I was kind of wondering about that because nobody wants to get in trouble with the IRS.
No, know, and, you know, prostitution is not really illegal at the federal level. As Lael said, it's the transportation across state lines for the purposes of prostitution that is illegal. So if somebody was driving me into Nevada to go to work at one of the legal brothels, they could still be and still are prosecuted. In fact, there was a case recently last year of a customer driving a worker into Nevada for the purposes of working in the brothel, and he has been charged under that trafficking statute, that federal trafficking statute, with a crime. Yeah.
You always want to know where the state line is and the county line and so forth. It can be really important in the South, I know, especially. Let's go to Renee, joins the program from Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Renee.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to address the there was an earlier statement about the history of legalization in Alaska. And in fact, we were never legal. We were decriminalized 10 days before the Raven decision. The legislature approved possession of 1 ounce of marijuana in public, providing it wasn't publicly used or displayed. Then Raven's decision was rendered by Chief Justice Rabinowitz roughly 10 days later, and it covered primarily privacy in the home. The 1983 compromise is what restricted us to 4 ounces in the home and did away with any public possession at all. And there a number of technicalities, including the 1983 compromise, then differentiating between hash, hash oil, and cannabis, that two of them were taboo, one of them was okay, sort of, kind of. But there was an earlier comment made differentiating between decriminalization and legalization, and it may have had to do with prostitution and toward a preference for decriminalization. And I just wanted to point out that whether you look at the doctrine of tolerance in Holland, which was also 1975, as was Raven, both remained illegal, which meant that the illegal trade behind the scenes didn't change much. In Alaska, late 70s, mom-and-pop grow operations since the crackdown, we've seen transition to gangbangers running a lot of stuff. That hasn't been for the better. But the trade itself, even at the heyday of looseness here, was still controlled by whatever entrepreneurs, organized or otherwise. And with decriminalization, you maintain the worst aspects of the war on drugs. You maintain the cartels because the commodity for sale is still technically taboo. So they don't take a hit. In fact, their sales probably go up with decrim. And you maintain the corruption in policing, the unreported seizures, the cash, all of that that goes on right now that people that wish to research it can. Decrim fosters both of those things. The change is that the kid with the $10 bag or nowadays $100 bag of pot gets sent home either free or with a ticket. But the two worst aspects of it maintain, whereas with all-out legalization, as much as I oppose the government being involved in my private business, including taxing and regulating, the only way you get rid of those two aspects, the corruption and policing, and I don't know if you could thoroughly get rid of it, but I guess minimize those two aspects, is all-out clean legalization.
Mm. Thanks, Renee, for clarifying that. I know up in your neck of the woods, they put a lot of thought into this. I appreciate
it. There's been a lot of people up here, good people, good neighbors, people with good integrity, sent to prison for very long times. And
I'm well aware of it.
It's obscene. It's an obscene war. But the answer to it is not to foster the two worst aspects of it through decrim. The answer to it is legalize.
Yeah. Well, let's zip on back to Doug Fine. You know, as you probably know, Doug, in Alaska, the law enforcement figured out how to monitor people's power bills in order to figure out if they had substantial grow operations. And, you know, it's not all that hard to do, and they could do this. And I guess that's just one example of a good deal of law enforcement time and effort and money, tax money, getting spent on something that could just be taxed.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is for cannabis to be removed from the Federal Controlled Substances Act and then to let states regulate it in a mode similar to alcohol. They'd give flexibility to municipalities. We have different cultural regions. Utah's alcohol laws are different than neighboring Nevada's, and that's for a reason, and cultures are different. And so I think the plan is for amongst the activists that I interviewed and, you know, tracked for a year is to just end federal federal prohibition and to hopefully have a similar effect to the alcohol prohibition then, which got rid of bootleggers and, you know, for better or for worse, we got NASCAR, but better than the Al Capone-run economy in Chicago.
I gotcha. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
It's an absolutely fascinating exploration of victimless crimes, decriminalizing or legalizing. And we've got an expert panel, and they know their stuff, and some really interesting and well-informed and respectful phone calls. We have Lael Morgan, the journalist, researcher, author of Good Time Girls with us. We have Mistress Max, the organizer of Erotic Service Providers Union in California, and Doug Fine, from New Mexico, author of Too High to Fail, which is just hot off the presses now, and a study of the cannabis industry and legal status and the economics involved. I'll throw in this one that comes from Brian in Petersburg, and it echoes something that came to my mind. You know, I remember we had a ballot measure to make marijuana illegal in Alaska. And so I did a Talk of Alaska about it, and I tried to get the people that were in favor of it and the people who were against it. And the person that wanted to come up and talk about this in favor of making marijuana illegal in Alaska was a guy that works for the P-Test company. Yeah. And Brian sort of goes along with this, too. He says, as part of this discussion, you also need to discuss the involvement of the private prison industry lobbying both federal and state legislators to prevent decriminalization. They spend millions on this effort. And I guess, Doug Fine, in your researches, you did discover that down through the years, there's been some investment in persuading people, some investment from, like, people that competed with hemp, some investment down through the years from various industries campaigning about the horrid dangers of devil weed marijuana.
Yeah, there's almost no truth involved in any of the arguments for keeping this expensive boondoggle trillion-dollar 40-year drug war going. There's only lies. There's no upside if you're looking at health rates, use rates, education budgets, crime rates, everything. Highway safety. Just about every study that comes out says about what the citizens know, which is that the drug war should end yesterday for the good of America, and it's very important. Even in this, you know, economic crisis and international Middle East dictators falling, it's actually not just a stoner college issue. It actually could have a real impact on the economy in a positive way. Before alcohol prohibition, alcohol at times in American history provided up to 70% of federal revenue. Now, of course, this was before the income tax. Nonetheless, not a minor factor. And so the cannabis is as the number one cash crop in the nation. Is even bigger. We haven't talked about industrial uses yet. But as far as the corrupting influence of drug war budgets and drug war money, it's true. I mean, you've got well-meaning law enforcement getting bestowed these gifts. One example that I wrote about in the book was for assisting the federal authorities with a raid
in Northern California. One sheriff was just unilaterally awarded $140,000 by the feds as part of their take of an American land, an American property. Like, thanks a lot. Here's $100,000+ for your effort. And, you know, that's totally legal and totally fine. And it's why former Seattle police chief Norm Stamper, now activist with law enforcement against prohibition, LEAP is a really interesting group because it's, you know, cops telling the truth. He says that basically one of the biggest side effects of the drug war has been the undermining of civil law enforcement in our democracy.
That's a really interesting point because I think we saw, you can go back in your social and cultural history and look at prohibition and the disrespect for the law that it implanted in the entire general population. And some of it lingers around even today. And when you go and make outlaws out of a bunch of people, how could they possibly have full respect for the law? You know, yeah. It's just basic. Okay, well, now that we've solved that one, let's turn back to Mistress Max's issue with Joe calling from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joe.
Yes, thank you very much. It's a very interesting program, and I've been listening closely. And I just really had a comment, and then I'll take the rest of the conversation off air. I just wanted to say that, you know, sex trafficking of minors from Alaska's villages and from Russia into Alaska has been a very opportunistic and violent type of ongoing crime in Alaska. And Alaska federal authorities as well as public health officials have been trying to investigate and respond to really this victimization of women. And so I don't hear that being addressed. Maybe it's not part of your conversation, but I thought it should be mentioned.
How do you know that?
How do I know that?
Yes.
Because I read the papers and I watch television and I read. So thank you very much.
All right, Joe, thank you. But, of course, it's in the nature of something involving a juvenile that the information is not going to be real available. And, you know, I don't have my hands on too many of those cases up here myself. Not saying they don't happen. I just...
Well...
Yes.
Well, so this is part of the narrative that has been put out there by the U.S. government under the Bush administration. You know, it was this narrative about forced labor, and, you know, they always use the children as the means to take away everybody's rights in America. You know, under the guise of bringing protection to children, everybody's rights have been stripped away as constitutional rights. And, you know, it's part of the Bush administration's narrative brought in by the Anti-Trafficking Victim Protection Act. And we see this narrative of being protected to children being used to stop other groups from having rights as well. In California, we just went through this with Prop 8, which was the ballot measure to mandate only opposite sex people to be married to each other as legal. Everybody else was illegal. And so they used the children narrative again. And, of course, when they
it came up here in Anchorage, now that you mention it, where there was
right.
a sort of campaign that says,
my little girl,
I don't want my little girl going into the little girl's room and there's a man in there who thinks he's a woman. Yeah.
Right. So these narratives that they use, it's fear-mongering that they use, and there's never any documentation. As long as these narratives have been carried by the U.S. government, who have in turn funded all these nonprofits to come on the air, to come on TV, and in the newspaper they're always quoted, and it's always this fear-mongering narrative. They never, ever have any documentation about these issues. And, of course, in our fast-paced media, we never, you know, journalists frequently never stop to ask and do their job to verify that what it is that they're reporting is an actual real situation. And our situation
well,
is...
And in a case like this, I mean, involving a juvenile, you wouldn't even be able to get much of anything. You could only get what prosecutors were telling you anyway.
Well, what part of the narrative is nationally is that every city in America is the hub for child sex trafficking. And it was Portland, Oregon, who actually, I think it was the Oregonian, their online publication.
All of them are? Wow.
No, they stopped.
stopped and they asked, they started doing the research to verify what the police were saying and what these nonprofits were saying, and they couldn't find any information to verify that any of this, you know, child sex trafficking business is true. So I would challenge the caller to really go and find some actual information. I would be very interested in any actual information.
And, well, as some of these people grow up and get older, assuming they're not in the graveyard, it seems like we might, some information might come to us eventually if there was something to come to us. Let's go to Chris, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
I just wanted to, I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. It's confusing listening to the radio because there's a slight delay because it goes through a satellite.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say thank you to Mistress Maxine for bringing some recognition. I have been in the industry for a very long time, and I am not a victim. I chose to be in this industry. I was a single mom for a long time, and without this sort of income, I wouldn't be able to have supported my child. And now I'm putting myself through school. And, you know, I just wanted to say, you know, what she said was that I've never seen any child trafficking. I've been in the industry for over 15 years. I've worked with people with lots of integrity. I've had a lot of support. And I see the need to decriminalize it and to stop, you know, it is this fear-mongering that women in this industry are victims. I've never seen that.
Chris, you can hear me over the phone, okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, no, let me ask you this. If you were, because this has come out, the minute that I told people that I was going to have a show on these issues, it seemed like everybody wanted to have a conversation with me about it. And so on behalf of many of those people that came up to me, would really want me to ask you, aren't you kind of backed into that situation? Is this really a matter of choice, or are circumstances such that you've been backed into it by whatever, the system, the sexism, capitalism, and so forth?
Well, that isn't particular to this industry, is it? I mean, most people choose to do things because of circumstances. I mean, I wouldn't say that this industry is any more, I'm backed into it any more than, I mean, I've had support, but that's not the same thing as being pressured or backed into it.
Mm.
I wouldn't say that was any more true in this industry than any other thing, any other industry people do.
Well, I really appreciate you stepping to the phone to talk to our listeners.
Mm-hmm. And if anything, I would say that a lot of my clientele are, you know, very high-profile people, and, you know, I'm very happy to have those connections. You know, it has helped me to be able to relate to anybody, to have intelligent conversations, to meet and relate to people on a different level that, you know, I don't get that interaction in sort of a normal 9-to-5 job. And to be honest with you, I'm happy with what I do. I mean, I come home and I'm not exhausted. I don't feel drained. And I'm not really sure that I would feel that way in a normal 9-to-5 job. I hear from friends that they're very unhappy. A lot of my friends are jealous of me because, you know, they have this fantasy idea of, you know, what my job is. And you know, I can understand that because I am very happy with what I do. You know, I'm able to support myself, put myself through school, and have a lot of free time. And it's really good for me, and that's why I've still been in this industry, and I haven't left.
All right, Chris, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad people got a chance to hear from you. Let's go to Jane, joins the program from Kenai. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jane.
Hi. Hi, Oil.
Hello.
Anyway, you know, I'd like to take a little bit of a middle ground with your guests here.
Oh, thank God.
you know, I don't have a problem with women who choose to be prostitutes, and I don't disbelieve that there are women who choose to go into this as a business. On the other hand, I think your guests are totally in denial about the fact that there are some, you know, sex trafficking is an issue. There were four men who were prosecuted in federal court in Alaska, I think in 2009 and 2010.
Oh, and the Russian, that was that Russian thing?
Yeah, it's Sabil Mumin Mujahid.
Uh-huh.
And three other guys, including the landlord of an apartment where the business took place. And, okay, so that's one point, is that, and also, who can forget, you know, the 15-year-old girl who was prostituted to Bill Allen, who was never prosecuted.
Yeah, that's a that's an interesting case, you know, because from those who have spoken with her, and I have not, you know, she is characterized as a highly manipulative person.
Well, I think that's hearsay, Steve.
Oh, I don't know but about I mean, that. Well, it's hearsay, obviously.
The fact that she, you know, that by law, someone underage is a victim, you know, whether you can't try her based on her personality.
Oh, no, I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing that.
You know, so she's clearly
I'll argue that.
She clearly was prostituting herself to Bill Allen. And by law, someone underage can't make a valid decision about that. So that's
right.
Just one point I'd like to make. And then the second one is
Jane, do you want to stay on the line here and let Mistress Max respond?
No, I want to make my other point first.
Okay.
And that is that, you know, I know that the case of prostitution in Fairbanks at the, you know, just past the turn of the century was one in which the women did have a lot of agency and own their own properties and by and large were free of pimps. But that wasn't the case to the whole gold rush. I mean, all you have to do is go and read in the files and the archives in Dawson City about women who did kill themselves. And thus, I think we're victims of the prostitution because they were addicted to drugs, actually, at the time. They killed themselves using drugs, and they were, you know, maybe it was like love gone wrong with their pimp or something like that, but I still would classify them as victims of prostitution. And so I don't think it was all like happy, everybody was an agency and, you know, there's never a problem with prostitution. I think there are problems with it. And I think that people who say that there are no victims are just, and that, you know, it's all this narrative fostered by the U.S. government are really in denial. I mean, the fact is there are no statistics from the turn of the century about the numbers of prostitutes or the numbers of women who died in the business.
Well, you're really pushing Lael's buttons now. I'm telling you, I think we got it. If you could stay on, Jane,
been for 20 years. So,
if you could stay on the line, you know, I'm happy to resume this. I just have to take a break. Is this all right, Jane?
Okay.
All right. As Talk of Alaska continues,
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
So we were in the midst of a conversation here where Lael Morgan, the author of Good Time Girls, was about to respond to Jane and Kenai, who said, no, it wasn't all sweetness and light. I don't think anybody, of course, is saying this is all sweetness and light, but she says there's a lot of downside in even Gold Rush era prostitution.
I have a quote from Paula Petrick, who did a wonderful book on Helena, Montana. She got the banking records. She got the death records. Coroner records for that town for a 35-year period. I've never seen more thorough research. She wrote, if in fact many prostitutes killed themselves, we would find evidence for their suicides in the coroner's reports and in vital statistics that register mortality rates. To be sure, there were suicides in the Tenderloin, two over a 35-year period in Helena, but there were far more suicides among men. We should also find vital stats, women perishing of drug overdoses, venereal disease, and so on. We don't. Western cemeteries are not filled with poor prostitutes who took their own lives, nor were victims of occupational hazards. We can then ask ourselves, what happened to them? That's a far more interesting question. And she has footnotes.
And just to go a little bit further, in your conversation with Jane here, what about Dawson?
Dawson had suicides among prostitutes. Nome had. Every town had suicides among prostitutes. But you might also want to back up and look at the suicides among minors and other citizens and wives. In Montana, we had more wives who were hooked on morphine and the stuff that was in patent medicines, cocaine. And some of those ended up in something called the Cabbage Patch, where they just became street people after being wealthy wives whose husbands put them aside. So there were lots of problems.
So Jane says she's not trying to minimize it. I'm not sure it's all that huge as you might think it is, Jane.
Well, I mean, I know Paula Petrek, actually, so I really respect her work. And, you know, it's a difficult subject. I think that Leo's right that, you know, there were certainly a percentage of suicides among all populations, among men, among, you know, wives, among prostitutes. But I don't think that should be used to minimize the fact that there were no, you know, and try to say that there were no victims of prostitution in the West. You know, that it's a purely victimless crime, you know, victimless crime, that it's not a crime, that it's a victimless activity.
Oh, no, I mean, it was a harsh life. I mean, yeah, the Gold Rush was a heartbreak factory. We all know that.
The problem is that it is, that the narratives that surround it are used for political purposes by both sides of the issue. I mean, there's certainly a narrative about white slavery that comes up in the 1910s. And then, I mean, as Mr. Smax has said, also recurs here in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
But
I really wanted to address...
And it's a narrative that's created for a political purpose doesn't mean that the underlying problem doesn't exist.
Okay, let's let Mr. Smax...
wanted to address the case that was adjudicated in 2009, the trafficking case. I followed that case quite closely. And what you saw there is you saw people who were being defrauded into the sex industry. You saw people workers being subjected to rape, robbery, theft, coercion and extortion of their labor, and those cases should have been charged as such. To charge them under this federal trafficking statute or the state trafficking statute really sets up this this conflation of all of those crimes together, and those victims never really even get justice for being raped or for being extorted from. And that sends a very strong message to those of us who work in the industry, and that is that it doesn't matter if you're assaulted on your job. It doesn't matter if you're a victim of theft. We only care about you if you want to come out and talk about how you're a victim of trafficking. And that is the problem with not having equal protection under the law. That's the problem with having the criminalization of prostitution across the board, is that it bars many of us from gaining equal protection under the law. The other issue is that here in Alaska, you know, you all have the serial killer here, right? The famous serial killer they just made a movie about it.
Oh, the Hansen case, yes.
That's right. And in that case as well, there were many women and prostitutes who came forward to make complaints to the Anchorage Police Department about being raped, beaten by this man, and they were ignored. It wasn't until they started finding the dead bodies, which is often the case, that the police even start to sit up and pay attention. And even in that particular case, the police were reluctant, the district attorney in Anchorage was reluctant to execute that search warrant to finally bring that justice there in that case, because he was an upstanding citizen. So this business of criminalization always leaves us in the second and third class citizenship, of which many immigrants are, subjected to as well, because they don't have the right to migrate for work.
And so those combinations of things leave our class in a severe disadvantage, and that's why we call for decriminalization across the board so we can get some transparency. And we would hope that people who really care about, you know, these victims, that they would stand with us and call for that at the state level.
Hmm. Jane, I want to thank you for your call.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, transparency. Let's use, toss that one back to Doug Fine. I guess we could use a little bit more transparency of the type that you're trying to bring to your to the issue of cannabis.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you shine the light on it. It was really the easiest journalistic story I've ever had to cover. I felt sometimes bad for the drug warriors. One point I was given GPS coordinates by a law enforcement public relations official where a raid was going on federal land, and of course I got lost and my GPS wasn't working, and this guy with an automatic weapon and fatigues comes up to me and starts doing his thing, screaming at me to get off, you know, my public land, and I'm paying his salary to get an automatic weapon ban. I mean, he was ready to use it. He clearly has stayed in the profession coming back from where he did have to use it overseas somewhere, and when I sort of, like, fumbled, I'm trying to pull out my press credentials and stuff like that, he kind of softened up, and it conveyed to me, a look on his face was like watching a Vietnam War documentary from 1972, and he's, you know, some poor corporal slogging it out in a rice field and just collecting a paycheck and counting the days. This guy was doing this job because it's a job, and he'd be happy to do some other job, and I just remember driving away thinking, I hope you can do some other job someday. Maybe looking into a real epidemic, the abuse of pharmaceuticals.
I will huff and I'll puff and I will blow your house down. We had this one here from Carl who sends an email from a vessel and says, basically backing you up, Mistress Max, but still saying, you know, CNN's had this massive effort to cover sex slavery. Are you trying to tell me that all that is being directed?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
It's all being directed. You know, the media profits greatly off the criminalization of prostitution. They, you know, love to run these salacious stories. They always depict us with our hands in handcuffs, usually showing us from the waist down, because we can't even, you know, have our faces. You know, that's why I have to be anonymous, even on this very program on radio, because we don't have access to equal protection, and because we're criminalized. And, you know, CNN makes a lot of money off of all those lock them up type shows and all that sex trafficking shows. It's part of the prison industrial complex. It's part of the way they profit, and it's part of the way that they work in concert together, because we know we have a great problem in our country with independent media.
All right. I want to thank all of our guests. Leo Morgan, thank you for being with us again. Doug Fine from New Mexico, and Mistress Max in the undisclosed location. Thanks again so much. And also, thanks to, we got Kristen Spack and Josh Edge, the A-Team today. I'm Steve Heimel. So long.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? We'll nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.